Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, how are the Yankees doing?
Well, they are undefeated in the postseason as of this podcast. But, of course, things could go bad and I could commit suicide. But until then, I think we should talk about something almost as important as the Yankees, and that is the war in Afghanistan.
Ken, we are marking this week a rather sad and anxious anniversary, the 8th of our conflict in Afghanistan.
It is the longest war in U.S. history, except for Vietnam. I don't know how long the 30 years war lasted, but that seems much longer. But still, it's a policy, and we still don't have a word from the Obama administration which way it wants to go. It does not want to withdraw the troops, but it doesn't want to put in the 40,000 troops or so that General Stanley McChrystal wants. So there's a confusion in the administration, and it's worrying allies, and it's certainly giving the Republicans some backbone to say that, look, if we lose, we, the United States, loses in Afghanistan, it's the Obama administration's fault.
The policymakers are not getting much guidance from the public on this one. Two interesting polls out this week from the Quinnipiac University poll and from Pew, both showing a remarkably similar results. People think it's worth it for the United States to be in Afghanistan and shedding American blood there, but they don't want to send any more troops, and they want the troops that are there now to come home soon. With respect to health care, it appears that people do not like the health care legislation moving through Congress. That is the overhaul the Obama administration supports. But all of the salient features of it, things like mandating people having health insurance and helping people pay for it, all those parts of it are individually popular.
Not the killing of the grandparents.
There's something about the image that people have of the health care legislation that is not polling well. Their idea about what's going on in Congress is very negative. And I'm wondering if it's not even so much what's in the bill, it's just the way it goes through Congress that people really don't like. They don't like the process.
Well, that's the whole point, because there is no bill. There is a Senate Finance Bill. There's a Senate Health Committee Bill. There are three House bills. But there is no bill that's going through Congress. And until we have that, it's hard for the American people to get their arms around it because they don't really exactly know what's in it.
So where are we right now in the process? We've got the Senate Finance Committee having completed its deliberations but not having had a vote, waiting for the Congressional Budget Office to come in with its scoring number, which it did. And that number this week was $829 billion as a 10-year impact on the federal budget. That's considered actually good news. So theoretically, they are going to go ahead and have a vote next week in the Senate Finance Committee, then it would perhaps move on later in the month to the Senate floor.
But before there's going to be a vote on the Senate floor, Harry Reid and the Democrats are going to have to pick and choose what they like from the Senate Finance Committee bill and what they like from the Senate Health Committee bill. And those are two different bills. The Finance Committee, of course, doesn't have the public option. The Health Committee does. The Health Committee bill is more expensive. So Reid and the Democrats still have to wrangle, and I say wrangle with a little irony there, because there's also three House bills. Charlie Rangel being the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, one of the committees involved in the health care process. So before we have a vote on the Senate floor, we have to choose what we like in the Senate, and then we have to choose what we like in the House, and then goes to the famous conference committee.
Okay, Reid, as the majority leader in the Senate, supposedly is going to have to compose these bills, harmonize these bills. Isn't the White House going to take some sort of a role in that, though? I mean, they're not going to leave it up to Harry Reid.
It would be nice. It would be about time.
Harry Reid is a guy who has hung on in terms of getting reelected. He's had some very close ones. I believe it was 1998 when he barely survived.
And against John Ensign. Remember him?
Yes, I remember John Ensign, and let's put that name just right up on the shelf just for a second as well.
But I mean, he's never been wildly popular back home, and so of course Harry Reid has to balance his conservative positions that are popular back home in Nevada.
Pro-gun,
and what he has
pro-life.
To do to make bananti pasta. And he has to combine all that with getting a more liberal Democratic caucus working together in Washington.
But Ken, here's the real question. Does Harry Reid have the kind of standing with his colleagues that he's going to need if he's going to enforce some sort of a deal to bring one bill to the floor of the Senate?
Well, the problem with Harry Reid is actually twofold. One, he's not great on television. Not that Tom Daschle was great, but certainly Tom Daschle was more presentable as a national figure than Harry Reid. And also, Harry Reid is constantly, if you look at his career back home in Nevada, he barely won re-election in 1998. His ratings have never been great back home. And so he's always looking over his shoulder to look at what people back home are thinking while he's trying to work out deals with his far more liberal colleagues here in Washington.
I've often wondered why Harry Reid, who, let's face it, has never really been a dominant figure in the Senate like a Teddy Kennedy or even in her short time in the Senate, Hillary Clinton, why is he the Senate Majority Leader and why has he been in that position since Tom Daschle left?
Well, he was Majority Whip and, of course, he was Minority Whip, too, and nobody seemed to want to challenge him. He's not wildly popular, but he's not unpopular either. He doesn't have many enemies. And I guess they just felt that he was good at counting votes when Daschle was running the Democratic side of things. So when Daschle left involuntarily,
he lost re-election in 2004.
Right, and then when Harry Reid came over, everybody was just talking about, okay, well, we'll have Dick Durbin be the new Harry Reid. But if you ask Dick Durbin, does he have any plans to challenge Harry Reid, or is there dissatisfaction with Harry Reid? Of course Dick Durbin will say no.
Well, he's working for him at this point. I mean, they are a team. They're the number one and the number two, and Durbin has the task of being the main conduit, if you will, of communication to Barack Obama. They used to be colleagues from Illinois, and that is still a great relationship for the White House to work in trying to get its will done in the Senate. But from time to time, there is talk that if Harry Reid has a really tough election next year, we don't know who his Republican opponent is going to be yet, but he always has a hard time in basically red state Nevada, maybe he should step aside and maybe somebody else could take his place. If it's not going to be Dick Durbin, who among the other senators might like to have this job? I remember Chris Dodd was interested in it at one time, but now
he ran for it.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a pretty full plate up there in Connecticut.
And a tough election next year as well.
So my thought turns to somebody else who's more or less in leadership. He has kind of an honorific title, but he used to be chairman of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. He was the guy who helped get them this 60-vote majority that they have now, the incredible success of the 2006 and 2008 campaigns.
You're not talking about the publicity-shy member from New York.
I'm talking about another Yankee fan, Ken. I think you might be able to think of his name.
Charles Schumer.
Yes, Charles.
Here's the thing, though. Harry Reid, especially given the fact that he has a tough re-election bout next year, the last thing he wants to go home and tell his people, the voters of Nevada, is that, well, I'm stepping aside as majority leader to concentrate on my re-election campaign.
Yeah, but just let me play devil's advocate for the moment. It has not been a big plus for people in recent elections to be able to go back home and say, hey, I'm a big leader in Congress. I'm one of the people who symbolizes the institution.
Remember the Herbert to Ernest McFarland in Arizona in 1952?
You know, and what happened to Bill Noland back in the 1950s as well, and Tom Daschle just a few years ago. Isn't it possible Harry Reid could go back and say, look, I stopped the effort to put all the nuclear waste at Yucca Mountain, and I've done the other things that I could do for Nevada. Now I'm going to step down as leader to concentrate on the needs of you, the little
guy. Not going to happen. Not going to happen.
Well, it would be unprecedented, I'll grant you.
And the irony of this, as you said, is that Harry Reid's numbers do not look good in Nevada. He's under 50%, and yet there is no Republican candidate to take him on. And the worst for the Republicans is that John Ensign, the once popular Republican senator from Nevada, whom Harry Reid barely defeated in 1998. John Ensign was hoping to lead the charge back, the Republican resurgence in Nevada, and that doesn't look like it's going to happen either.
Well, it's not going to happen because the New York Times and some other news organizations have revived these charges of what John Ensign did on behalf of his former chief of staff, Douglas Hampton. The senator has acknowledged having an affair with Hampton's wife and then trying to more or less cover that up by getting people to find jobs for Mr. Hampton and then perhaps making some sort of lobbying moves on Mr. Hampton's behalf. And it all looks pretty bad, but Ensign says he's not resigning.
I hate to turn off the listener here, but this is not about sex. And I know this listener listens to the podcast so we can talk about sex, but it is abuse of, or at least the charge is abuse of office. And if John Ensign did try to get Douglas Hampton a lobbying job, and if he did intervene with government agencies on behalf of Hampton's clients, well, that is clear misuse of his office, and the Senate Ethics Committee is looking into it.
Yes, the Senate Ethics Committee is looking into it is one of those phrases that really does freeze time, don't you think? And this is going to go on for quite a while. So those who feel that there's an outrage factor here and that John Ensign owes the public some sort of explanation are calling on him to resign. He says, no way, I'm not resigning. I have nothing further to say on this subject, and we'll wait for the Senate Ethics Committee to express its opinion. And so we've got Harry Reid doesn't want to step down from his Senate Majority Leader responsibilities. We've got John Ensign doesn't want to resign. And we've got another controversy going on Capitol Hill right now that involves somebody saying there's no reason for him to resign when an awful lot of other people wish he would. And that's another New Yorker, Ken.
And we're talking about Charles Rangel, first elected in 1970, defeating the legendary Adam Clayton Powell. He's African-American, and I mentioned that for a reason, but I'll get to that in a second. He's pivotal in the fight for health care. But first, let's talk about what the issues are, that he has apparently hundreds of thousands of dollars of income that he has not reported.
Offshore income from property he owned in the Dominican Republic.
Right. And this is, there's more and more incidents like this about rental property, about income he's gotten and all that stuff.
Having multiple apartments in New York under rent control. You don't understand that, huh?
Right. And he refuses to step down. And, of course, the difference with John Ensign and Charlie Rangel is that I think Democrats are standing by Charlie Rangel. There was an effort in the House this week to remove Rangel from the chairmanship of Ways and Means until the Ethics Committee completes its work. Of course, we'll be dead by then. The Democrats are standing behind him, whereas the Republicans in the Senate don't seem to be anxious to be quoted talking on behalf of John Ensign. But back to Charlie Rangel, there's problems if you remove Charlie Rangel. And that is one, of course, as I said, we're talking about health care and his role in the pivotal work. Two, if he's deposed as Ways and Means Committee Chairman, Pete Stark of California, who's pretty much out there as a liberal, to say the least, would take over. And a lot of moderate Democrats don't trust Pete Stark at all. And Pete Stark, is, of course, can be very cantankerous and obnoxious. And most people like Charlie Rangel.
A lot of the people that give money to the Democrats, because the Democrats are in control and because they're writing legislation and regulations for the financial industry and other industries, are not happy about the prospect of losing Charlie Rangel. And after all, he is a New Yorker and he has not exactly been the scourge of Wall Street, but they're afraid of Pete Stark, the way you suggest.
Right. But the third thing, and this is not to be understated at all, is that the Congressional Black Caucus is very wary about any kind of move to remove Charlie Rangel as chairman of Ways and Means. There's still lingering resentment of what House Speaker Nancy Pelosi did with Bill Jefferson, another member of the Black Caucus, a then-congressman from Louisiana. She stripped him of his committee assignments because of allegations of corruption.
Since have led to his indictment
and
conviction.
Exactly. And he's no longer a member of Congress. He was defeated last year. But there's still raw feelings about that. And the last thing that Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats want is a racial controversy that involves the removal of a black chairman of Congress.
Another development in New York politics this week, the rise of the Conservative Party candidate in the New York 23rd District special election coming up next month.
The reason everybody's paying attention to this is because we remember what happened the last special election in New York. That was New York 20. That was a Kirsten Gillibrand House seat that was supposed to be won back by the Republicans, but the Democrats kept it. And now we have New York 23, further upstate, never having elected a Democrat in its history.
Ever.
Ever.
Seriously. It's never had a Democrat, not in the New Deal, not in any other era?
No, not during the Big Deal. No, nothing. Never. Not during, never. Okay, but so this district has never, in the history of mankind, personkind, has never elected a Democrat to this district. This is the one that John McHugh represented for a while until he was nominated and confirmed and bar mitzvahed as Secretary of the Army. So the Republicans thought they would keep it. Didi Scozzafava.
Didi Scozzafava is the official backed candidate of the Republican Party in the 23rd District.
She's a longtime state assemblywoman, a very moderate positions on many issues, and that has angered many conservatives there, and they're backing a conservative by the name of Doug Hoffman, who has the endorsement of the Club for Growth, Gary Bauer, very important in upstate New York, the American Conservative Union, things like that. So it could split the Republican vote on November 3rd and elect Democrat Bill Owens.
That would be a remarkable, and what would that then make the ratio of Democrats and Republicans in the state of New York in the House?
They would have only two left in New York. By the way, Ron, if you leave New York and take the New Jersey Turnpike, if you take 95 South, you wind up in Delaware, and there was some big political news out of Delaware this week.
Mike Castle, once the governor and for many years the lone member of the House of Representatives from Delaware, has declared himself a candidate for the United States Senate, putting himself on a collision course with the son of Vice President Joe Biden, Beau Biden.
That's right. Mike Castle has been elected statewide 12 times, 9 in the House, 2 as governor, 1 as lieutenant governor, and he's a centrist Republican, probably the only Republican who has a chance of taking what had been Joe Biden's Senate seat. Of course, it's now Ted Kaufman's Senate seat, but coincidentally, Joe Biden's best friend, Ted Kaufman, says, I'm not going to run in 2010, and coincidentally, Bo Biden, the state attorney general, who's now back from Iraq, says, I might run for the Senate in 2010. But it's going to be a good race. Tom Carper, who is obviously a Democrat and very close to Joe Biden, has a great respect for Mike Castle and said this is going to be one for the ages. This could very well be one for the ages. Perhaps the two most popular politicians in Delaware running for an open Senate seat.
A barn burner in Delaware and potentially a race developing in Wisconsin. We may be reaching here a little bit because we haven't seen anybody actually get into the race against Russ Feingold, who was also elected in 1992. Russ Feingold might be on cruise control this time around after some very close elections, except now here comes 4 times elected governor, ex-governor, Tommy Thompson.
He ran a very, very successful race for the Republican presidential nomination that lasted over 6 hours.
Nobody remembers that, Ken.
Nobody ever heard from him
since. Tommy Thompson denies it, I think. He was, however, the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services.
Nobody remembers that either. And he battled with the Bush administration during that appointment as well. There are no Republicans on Capitol Hill who supports the health care plan, so the Obama administration is looking for Republicans who don't have a vote in this whole thing. They got some kind word from Arnold Schwarzenegger, who said, yes, I like the fact that Obama is trying to get this accomplished. Michael Bloomberg, a nominal Republican.
Well, truly nominal.
But he's a Republican nominee for mayor.
Nominal nominee.
Bill Frist, the former Senate Majority Leader from Tennessee, no longer a senator, no longer somebody with a vote, also says that he could see himself supporting something that's coming out of Congress on health care. And now Tommy Thompson as well. He and Dick Gephardt have announced that they are inclined to support a health care legislation because the status quo is unacceptable. So Tommy Thompson's name has been out there as well. I think if anything, Tommy Thompson misses the fact that he's no longer governor. I think he felt that giving up the governorship to join the Bush administration was a mistake on his part. He left Wisconsin very, very popular. He'd probably rather run for governor, although that race seems to be closing off between two other Republican candidates.
Why doesn't he run for governor? Because those other two Republican candidates are not particularly strong. One of them, Mark Newman, has run statewide before and been defeated.
And I loved him in Mad Magazine, right?
It just seems to me that if Tommy Thompson wants to move back to Madison and be governor again, that's an office that is open in 2010.
Yeah, I think that makes more sense for Tommy Thompson and the kind of skills he represents than coming to Washington as a freshman senator.
Tommy Thompson then being mentioned as a potential candidate against Russ Feingold in Wisconsin because the Republicans really are still looking for somebody to take up that particular cudgel, and Tommy Thompson is still popular in the state. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Slash-Elving.
As you should be. And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Tommy Ken.